Good morning, everyone. Everyone awake and ready? Good. Let us pray together.
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. Welcome this morning. I feel great bliss being with you this morning. Sometimes I wonder how God can expect me to stand up and start to speak after he fills me up so much. From Papa Ram Dass, Realizing Undying Truth, a poem. When you are lost in the gleam and flash of divine light, and your soul bathes in endless peace, when love flowers in your heart, and you are sunk in ecstasy, being the child of the Supreme Beloved, you know you and he are one, then you have conquered death and earned the blessedness of immortality. Reading from Master's Commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. This is chapter 1, beginning with verse 1. Dhritarashtra said, "On the holy plain of Kurukshetra, when my offspring and the sons of Pandu had gathered together, eager for battle, what did they do, O Sanjay?" Master's Commentary. The blind king, Dhritarashtra, the blind mind, inquired through honest Sanjay, impartial introspection. In other words, Sanjay represents impartial introspection. And it's the blind mind, the mind that is not awakened to its spiritual nature, that's asking the question. When my offspring, the Kurus, the wicked, impulsive, mental, and sense tendencies, and the sons of the virtuous Pandu, this pure discriminative tendencies, gathered together on the Dharmakshetra, or the holy plain of Kurukshetra, the bodily field of activity, eager to do battle for supremacy, what was the outcome? The earnest inquiry by the blind king Dhritarashtra, seeking an unbiased report from the impartial Sanjay, as to how fared the battle between the Kurus and Pandavas, the sons of Pandu, at Kurukshetra, is metaphorically the question to be asked by the spiritual aspirant as he reviews daily the events of his own righteous battle, from which he seeks the victory of self-realization. Through honest introspection, he analyzes the deeds and assesses the strengths of the opposing armies of his good and bad tendencies. Self-control versus sense indulgence. Discriminative intelligence opposed by mental sense inclinations. Spiritual resolve and meditation contested by mental resistance and physical restlessness. And the divine soul consciousness against the ignorance and magnetic attraction of the lower ego nature. Master here speaks of the reflective mind. And I would also take it to a little bit different kind of take on it, which is the ability to reflect on your own experience. This, I think, is an essential aspect in gaining some ground on the spiritual path. When you are able to question yourself, when you are able to observe yourself and your own nature, your own behavior, and being able to both analyze it, but just the ability to stand back and be able to observe, what is it that you're thinking? What is it that you're feeling? What is it that you're sensing through the five senses? That this is a marked change in the psychology of human nature. There will be people, and some of them, who adhere to a spiritual path or discipline, who, for one reason or another, are not able to take this observational mode. They may say, and I've heard people say, well, it's just my nature. That's just the way that I am. There is no distance between the individual I and whatever is occurring through the thought, the feelings, or sensations that the person is experiencing at the time. When you're unable to have any observation, you cannot have distance. You are completely identified with whatever it is that you're experiencing. And when you're completely identified with it, you cannot become freed from it. So this is an absolutely essential aspect, is to be able to observe what it is that you are thinking, what it is that you are feeling, and what it is that you are sensing. Any inability, any area of your life that you're not able to do this results in being bound to whatever it is that you're experiencing. So this is an exercise that I take many individuals through, is to be able to observe what is it that you are experiencing in the moment. And when you are able to take that observational mode, you by definition take one step back from whatever it is that is being observed. Now you have a subject and an object. You are the subject. What you're observing is the object. There's a little distance between you and that. You can't observe something unless you stand back and are able to see it from a little bit of a distance. So this is an important beginning step in the spiritual path, and it's really a wonderful practice for you to be able to do. It's a beginning of honesty, for one thing. You can begin to bring your own thoughts and behaviors out into the open. And when you bring it out into the open, you openly acknowledge it. You see it. You begin to encounter it. When we keep it so close to ourselves and identify with it, we can't really see what it is that we're doing or experiencing. So as you go about in your daily life, you can just practice with small things. I've spoken about before about when I read the book by Eugene Herigold on Zen and the Art of Archery, and he was explaining the discipline that he went in and learning how to become the observer while he was performing this archery. So he was both acting and observing. It's a terribly difficult thing to do in the beginning, especially when you're doing a very exacting task, as his Zen master had him doing with the archery. There's a real science behind the whole thing. And he described how his Zen teacher demonstrated for him in the beginning that he went out onto an archery field at nighttime. And there, at a distance down the field, were the archery targets. And then the master asked for the lights to be turned out. And he shot one arrow, and he heard the twang, and then he shot the second arrow, and he heard the second twang. And then they turned the lights back on. And when he went to the target, he saw that the first arrow hit the target exactly in the center. And the second arrow had split the first arrow down the center. So exacting was the master in his ability to master this art of archery. And so I began to take that idea and apply it to all different kinds of things that I did. And so when I was driving, it was Zen and the Art of Driving. If I was washing the dishes, it was Zen and the Art of Washing the Dishes. And what you do is you just become very aware of even small, minute body motions, how you're holding yourself, your posture, you become an observer of every little bit of your experience in the moment. In fact, you can't really be anywhere other than in the moment when you're observing your body and its relationship to other things in this kind of a way. And so it's a wonderful practice in the beginning to gain this observational mode and to begin to understand how things really operate. The mind has all kinds of theories on how things work in the world. But to really understand from an intuitional standpoint how things operate in the world, you have to have this still, quiet mind, and that can only come by taking a step back from how you think, how you feel, and what you sense. And as you'll notice, this is no easy task, particularly if you're busy in the world, if you have some physical pain, if you have other kinds of habitual thoughts running through your mind. It just seems natural. That's just me, isn't it? Well, it's not. It's not. And to continue with Master's writing under this topic, then, he goes on, a comparison of the senses as ruled by the soul and as ruled by the ego. And this is what Master terms the estate of procreation. Under soul's rule, Prince-controlled creative impulse rightly guides the sex inclination, enabling parents to bring on earth, by law of attraction, other noble spiritual human beings like themselves, who will, by example, guide matter-entangled souls, inspiring them to retrace their footsteps toward spiritual blessedness. Under soul's guidance, the sex impulse in man may also be transmuted into the creation on a purely spiritual plane of noble ideas, of artistic masterpieces, of soul-revolutionizing books. Under the ego regime, Prince Promiscuity lives an unbridled passion. The bodily kingdom is kept constantly excited and restless with morbid impulses of sex temptation. The insatiable lust imparted to the thought citizens make them sense slaves, subject to moodiness, depression, irritability. The cellular inhabitants suffer debility, ill health, and premature old age and death. At the beginning of the cycle of manifested creation, God materialized all forms by direct, special creative command. The Word, or the cosmic creative vibration of Om, with its manifest powers of creation, preservation, and dissolution. God endowed man, made in his omnipotent image, with the same creative power. So this is a wonderful thing. Swami Ashokananda told Mother that when, during the Golden Age, that a man could impregnate the women or quicken within her womb that which was necessary in order to create a new baby. And he could do it by putting one hand on her breast or putting a hand on her lower abdomen region. And through thought impregnation would create the seed there that would then create a human being. That may sound fantastic to some, but this is what he said. And he was a man of tremendous realization himself. He was one who manifested many of these kind of miraculous powers in his own life. There's a young woman that Mother met there that her mother was unavailable to give her suckle when she was a young child. And this Swami Ashokananda, through his own breast, was able to feed this young baby when she was first born into the world, and as a result, she was able to live. There are many snakes all around in the region, and because of his blessings, no one was ever bothered by the snakes as long as they had the blessings of the Swami to come and go as they pleased. And there is no water originally in this land, and one day the Swami took his hand and he put it right into the ground, and when he pulled it up, a spring of water came out. and I made a small lake there. So this is a wonderful, wonderful individual, and he had many transcendent kinds of experiences. And yet when Mother met him, and they had wonderful conversations, and Mother thought the world of him, thought he was really tremendous in God. And one day, Swami Ashokananda asked Mother, "Can you give me what I want?" Mother thought he must be referring to what she must do in order to have her own complete realization, to give up her ego, to do whatever was necessary. And so she said, "Yes, Swami, I think so." And then that night, as Mother sat absorbed in God, God said, "No, that's not what he meant. He meant, can you give me God realization?" And Mother was shocked at this because she had such high regard for this great God-man. And indeed, he was a great God-man. And so the next day, she went to Swami Ashokananda and she asked him, "Is this what you meant? This is what God told me." And he said, "Yes." He said, "I went up to the ocean, but I found that I couldn't dive in." Now, here's a man that when he was yet a boy, he tried to meditate. He was very sincere. I believe that he was 9 years old, and his brothers and the other boys gave him such a hard time. He quit the village, and he quit mankind, as a matter of fact. He just went out into the jungles, and he lived there by his own wits because he wanted to meditate on God. And at first, he was affected by the weather. If it got cold, then he was shivering, and he told God. He said, "How can I concentrate on you when I'm feeling this cold? You must take care of it." God lifted him out of that sensation of cold, and from that moment on, he never experienced any heat or any cold. He was in perfect equanimity, no matter what was going on in the weather outside. Wouldn't that be a wonderful faculty to have? And so he wore very few clothes. His clothes eventually dropped off of him. And he spoke in a barely audible whisper when he was with Mother, because for so many years he didn't speak at all. And this is a great, great God-man. And yet he was asking Mother, "Can you give me what I want?" And so Mother said yes, that she could. So we trust that that happened. Back to Master's writing. God endowed man, made him in his omnipotent image with the same creative power. But Adam and Eve, symbolic of the first pairs of human beings, yielded to touch temptation, lost the power of immaculate creation, by which they had been able to clothe all their mental pictures with energy and life, thus materializing children from the ether, bringing them into manifestation from the ideational world, even as gods. Man and woman, instead of seeking emancipation in God through soul unity, sought satisfaction through the flesh. The seed of the original error of Adam and Eve remains in all human beings as the first temptation of flesh against the immaculate laws of spirit. "Touch not the tree in the center of the garden," quote from the Bible. Each individual, since that dim era, has had to engage his soul in battle with the cosmically present temptation of sex. The Creator in man has become a dictatorial creature. The sixth sex impulse in the single most physically magnetic power, that pulls the life and consciousness down from spirit in the higher centers in the brain, out through the coccygeal center into matter and body consciousness. The beginner in yoga meditation experiences all too definitely how grounded he is by the stubborn attachment of his life and energy to the body, sometimes without realizing that it is his uncontrolled thoughts and acts of sex that are primarily responsible for his earthbound condition. The seeker after self-realization is therefore urged by yoga to take command of this rebel force. Married couples should practice moderation, with love and friendship predominating. The unmarried should abide by the pure laws of celibacy in thought as well as in act. And one of the things you come to realize when you are trying to manage the sex impulse is that thought precedes all feeling and all emotion. And so our ability to control our thoughts is absolutely essential when it comes to controlling sex impulse. We have to understand, in the old kind of sense of moralizing, that sex is dirty or sex is somehow forbidden or these kinds of things, it's not really like that at all. We just need to understand the principles that govern this body, this nature, and how it is that we can free ourselves if we choose to do so at any particular time. When I first started this path, I was but a man of 20, and I had all the natural sex impulses, if not more, than the average person. And so it was really quite a thing to try to take the sex energy and bring it up through the spine. And it's very easy, particularly in the beginning, to try to repress these things. Well, I just don't want to have to deal with it. I don't want to have to think about it at all. But that doesn't work so well. That's called repression. That's pushing it back down. And then the other tendency is to get obsessed with it, to begin to put it on the merry-go-round of the mind, and around it goes. So we must be able to do something differently with it. When I was in India for the first time, I was speaking to a yogi there. He's actually a follower after master. And so we were talking about the sex impulse. I was asking him what he had recommended to his students, and he didn't have too much, really. And I said, well, one thing that God showed me, I said, was that just down at the base of the spine, there is something that was envisioned in my mind there. It was like a trap door with a spring, and it was shut. And when I saw that trap door open up with a snap of the spring, up flowed the energy through the spine, and it went up into the higher centers. And what a relief it was to the lower centers. It took all the pressure off of these centers. And he said, well, leave it to the Americans to come to think up these kinds of things. So this is something that you can do. You see, when you experience the creative life that is within you, that's contained within you, and it's residing down in the lower centers, it acts like pressures on the nerves there. And it makes you want to express it. And you feel like if you can't express it, sometimes you feel like you want to explode. But as you guide it up and you see this trap door open up, you feel that flow of life energy go up your spine. And you feel the wonderful effects on your heart center, on the ajna at the top of your head. And through this positive association, you are no longer in repression, but this is transmutation. You're transmuting the energy from the lower centers into the higher centers. You can also use that creative energy for writing, for artistic efforts. You can use it for physical activity. There are various ways of transmuting it and letting it at least be used through the body and kind of a neutralizing kind of factor. Or you can draw it up into the higher spiritual centers, to the ajna, to the sahasrara at the top of the head, to the heart center, and there have a very positive inward spiritual experience. Now you no longer feel like you're missing out on something, such as a sexual union with another person, but you feel like you're gaining a union with your inner soul, which is completely satisfying. Sexual union is a hit and miss kind of proposition, even under the best of circumstances. And the satisfaction level oftentimes isn't there. But when you have the uplifting spiritual force within you, you can have complete union now, always, and it has a tremendously satisfying aspect to it. It's fulfilling to you. It's really, when you really come into it and see it for all of its beauty and its glory that it is, you see it's what you've really been yearning for through countless sexual partners down through time. And so you have that fulfillment, you have that completeness. I remember there was a material part of my mind, and I just didn't believe that God could satisfy me, that part of my mind didn't, in the same way that a physical union can. But you find out that God is really fulfilling to the maximum. And that everything that you yearn for through the physical senses is actually completely satisfied in God. It's surprising to me, number one, when I entered into spiritual experiences, how physical and how totally it engaged me. It wasn't something so ephemeral and so out there that it was completely disconnected from this physical being. It incorporated the physicality. I remember that once when I was sitting for Mother's talk and I was going through these kinds of experiences, and I used to sit in the back of the dining room at Bonnie's home because I didn't want anybody to see me as I went through some of these different kinds of experiences because it affected my body. And sometimes my body would be swaying and it would be rotating, first in one direction and then the other from the waist up. And as this was occurring, my vision was taken to the very center of my head, and I was looking straight down the back of my spine. And as I was rotating in this peculiar kind of fashion, I saw there the head of a serpent coming up. Now, this wasn't anything I'd been particularly thinking about or invested in kind of knowing, but it was interesting to me that all around the world, this life energy is regarded as a serpent. It is in the Old Testament, the New Testament. And it was interesting to me that Jesus used the term serpent all in positive nature, whereas in the Old Testament, it's regarded as something of the negative. It's the tempter, isn't it? And there the serpent is coming down the tree, pointed downward. But in Jesus, he said, even as Moses raised up the serpent in the desert, so must the Son of Man, so must we all. And so here was this head of the serpent, it looked like a cobra, rotating with my own spine in the same circular kind of fashion as it was coming up. And it was fascinating to see. And then the rotation would go in a different manner. And it was not of my own choosing at all. It was something that was happening inside of me. And this is the thing that you begin to understand, is that when you really surrender yourself to God, you feel these divine energies moving through you, that you have to move in these particular ways that it does, that it chooses to. And it all has to do with the alignment of the body with the spirit, with the mind and with the spirit. And the mind has to surrender, has to become the observer. And if you fight it and resist it, it turns into a tremendous sense of pressure. And if you resist it enough, and occasionally this happens, people come into these experiences, and for one reason or another, they get scared, or they are embarrassed, or whatever the reason is, and they force it away, they push it away. And if you will it strong enough, you can stop these experiences from happening. But if you surrender to them, if you attune yourself to them, if you go along with them, then they will transform you. Now, it doesn't happen in a day. Mother used to say that Rome was not built in a day. Neither does God realization happen in a day. It is a transformative experience, and it may go on for many, many years. It has in my own case. And I ascribe that mostly because I have not had the purity of consciousness to keep my mind strictly upon God down through the years. So there have been times when I've taken steps forward and then I took a few steps back. And back and forth it went. But one thing you'll notice when that happens is that when you take steps back, it becomes more and more painful. You notice what the results are from not completely surrendering yourself to God. And so you realize that it's in your own best self-interest to completely and totally surrender yourself and put your mind completely on God. So these are the wonderful things that happen when you begin to really put yourself into the spiritual path and you see the transmutation of this sexual energy. Master continues here. They are blessed who are victorious over the sexual instinct, because suppression may only increase one's difficulties. Yoga teaches teaches the sublimation. The average person can be free of temptation by avoiding the company, environments, books, movies that stimulate sex thoughts, and by training the armies of self-control, by seeking good company, by proper diet, eating little or no meat and taking more fresh fruits and vegetables, by exercising regularly, by engaging in creative activities such as art, invention, writing. Above all, by keeping the thoughts on the wonder, peace, and all-satisfying love of God, the insatiable desire for pleasure of sex is transmuted by the divine love and ecstatic joy experienced in deep meditation. And again, as a young man, I enjoyed pop music of the time. And so what to do? There are so many things about love songs, and there are other songs about you done me wrong kind of songs. So I transmuted those kind of songs, and if they were love songs, then they were love songs to God, how you can't live without God, how you want God so badly, how the union with God is so wonderful, and so on. If it was a you done me wrong song, that became a song about Maya, about delusion, and how by going down the wrong road, it betrays you. And, you know, the joke about if you play country and western music backwards, then you get your dog back, you get your pickup back, you get sober, and so on, because that's playing the song backwards. And so if you just transmute everything that comes to you as about your love affair with God, it's a wonderful thing. It's a very dry path, actually, to take the total path of the Yani, not to give your heart to God. Sri Yukteswar, who is such a great, great Yani, that is, a soul of discrimination and wisdom, said in his book that the bhakti was absolutely essential to gaining God realization. It is the turning of your whole life over to God. It is that feeling of desire, keen desire and aspiration for God. This must happen for all souls. Now, it varies a bit depending on the temperament of the individual, how that manifests. But it all boils down to when you direct your heart, your mind, and your soul towards God, you lift this energy up through the spine, and you bring it into the kingdom of freedom. And this is what you feel, you see, when you free yourself of the sex impulse and that obsessive nature around sex. When you rise above that, you feel a tremendous sense of freedom, a tremendous sense of freedom. And now when you look at somebody who in the past you would have felt perhaps a sexual impulse towards, now you see a soul, a child of God, a being of pure light. You look deeper into their nature. You look beyond the skin. You look beyond the hair. You look beyond the other features that perhaps would have attracted you before. And you see the personality. You see them more clearly. And then, as you teach yourself and you purify the mind, you go beyond the personality. You see God within that personality. Now, if you see an individual who is not living up to their highest light, they're not doing that out of happiness. They're not doing it out of peace and fulfillment. They're doing it because they're in pain. And where before you may have found somebody with unlovely qualities, now you see the inner God self battling against those very same qualities. And if you think it's bad being around that person for a few minutes or a few hours or a few days, they have to live with themselves 24/7. And they live with that pain. They live with that ignorance. They live feeling controlled by desires that aren't really edifying or fulfilling for them. And from that standpoint, you can feel compassion for the individual. What are they missing out on in life? How much they're not able to experience the peace, the joy. Now, they may make other people's lives miserable, particularly if the other people around them are susceptible to it. But you don't have to be susceptible to it. You can free yourself of the other person's behavior and their thoughts and their projections. You can let them pass right on by you and just see them disappear over the horizon behind you. You don't have to be influenced. You may still see it, sense it. You may see it, and you may be affected to some degree, but it doesn't hang on you. You let it go instantly, and you don't have to be controlled by it. You can remain in freedom, even when you're in the midst of an individual or people who are not of the highest mind. And yet, as Master says here, it's better if we keep the company of people who are on the higher level. But we don't always have control of our environment through our workplace and through other associations. We may find we occasionally come into contact with people with what we might call unlovely qualities. But even then, you can free yourselves of being dominated by another person. And just think of it. Would that person that you're having difficulty with, is that the person you would choose to be in control of your life? And yet, aren't you giving them control when you allow them to influence you to such a profound degree because of their thoughts, their behavior, their words? So it is important that we free ourselves and that we transmute that experience as well. The bravest of prophets, Master continues, dare to intrude their often unwelcome voices into the realm of this natural instinct to remind of the scriptural injunctions against promiscuity, adultery, aberrant behavior, indulgences, and modern world calls free love. Now, I found this very interesting because Master wrote this in either the 1930s or 1940s. I didn't know that free love was a common kind of thing. I thought that was the invention of the 60s, but I guess there's nothing new under the sun, really. Slavery to sex is seldom based on love, and it is never free. Say that again. Slavery to sex is seldom based on love, and it is never free. Condemnation by religious moralists, however, does little more than create feelings of guilt in the so-called sinner, or cause him either to turn against religion, or more commonly, to justify his behavior by associating with those of comparable standards, the availability of whom is never lacking. Morality, like a chameleon, tends to take on the color of the circumambient society. But the inscrutable laws of nature, through which God upholds his creation, are ever unaltered by man's determinations. The simple fact is, man enslaves himself in bonds of karmic fetters whenever he transgresses any sacred code of nature. And then, when suffering results, he woefully cries, "Why me, Lord?" Understanding is the art of untying the Gordian knot bound by ignorance. Understanding is the art of untying the Gordian knot bound by ignorance. Thus, yoga teaches why man, nature's highest achievement, should have respect for her sacred mode of procreation, and correspondingly, why it should not be abused. Consider as a start that every being is in essence a soul, made in the image of God, neither man nor woman, but in the embodied state possessing both masculine and a feminine nature. The masculine tendency manifests in the power of discrimination, self-control, exacting judgment, all the qualities of reason or intellect. The emotional element in every being consisting of tenderness of love, sympathy, kindness, mercy, all the qualities of feeling constitute the feminine nature. Unless these two phases are properly united and harmonized, spiritual procreation, whose offspring is permanent peace, is impossible. Spiritual procreation requires the proper mating within oneself of the sterner masculine qualities with the softer feminine nature. It results in and manifests in the birth an expression of true knowledge and total self-contentment. In one who has attained self-realization, this perfect union has been achieved. In the ordinary man, the imbalance makes him dissatisfied and restless. The attraction between man and woman, when based on true love and not sexual obsession, is the effort of the soul to regain its normal harmony. This gives birth to the oft-abused argument proclaiming the necessity to seek out and find one's soulmate. But all too frequently, attraction for the wrong reasons results instead in cellmates. And I oftentimes reflected on Mother, and she was the combination of these two natures, of the feminine and masculine. She had a strong feminine nature. She was a mother at heart. She was loving. She was tender. She was compassionate. She had all of these things with her. But she was also tough. She was also very discriminating. She was also very wise in that sense. She had a will of iron, those masculine features. Now, these are not things that are to say one is better than the other. They just simply are. They're part of our nature. It's a way of understanding and thinking about the various aspects of our own nature. And so to bring these two things into harmony and into balance with each other is what each one of us should be all about. If you notice that one nature is predominant over the other, then just work to bring the other into balance. If you find that you are of a stern, exacting kind of nature, and you give very little slack to anybody else, then look for ways to soften your nature. Look for ways to express your loving kindness nature. And just the opposite, of course, is true as well. If you are of a very loving, soft kind of nature, but you have difficulty making the hard decisions, making those decisions that are clear, that are concise, then practice in small situations through your day, bringing that exacting nature forward. Take a stand. Make it clear. Make it incisive. And then go about your duty. And through this, we can balance our natures. And this is the way that God created each and every one of us. And the Adam and Eve nature is truly balanced within each and every one of us. These are tremendous things. These are tremendous truths that we are being taught here. In order to really make progress, though, we have to put them into action. We can't just listen and then go off on our way. This is a path of work. This is a path of action. This is a path of putting into our lives these highest, most noble, these highest-minded truths. And so we should reflect on these things. We should think about them throughout the week and really make it a point to try to bring this kind of balance into our lives. So there's the human that contains both the feminine and the masculine. There's the transmutation of the sexual energy. And with that transmutation comes freedom. Comes your freedom. And now you are able to see other souls more clearly. You are able to see into your own divine nature more clearly. Just look around this world. See how much trouble is made up from people with uncontrolled sexual desire and their expression of it, and sometimes their perversion of it. And you will see that we pay a very, very high cost for this free love. And as Master said, it's not usually love based on love, and it never comes for free. So that's the truth. That's the truth. Whether we want to acknowledge it or not, it's still the truth. And so we need to learn about these things, not out of guilt, not feeling bad, but out of being interested in it. Out of wanting to understand about human nature and start to bring out the very best, the very highest that each one of us have. To put your mind on God, to love God with all of your heart, all of your mind, all of your strength and your soul. And when you do that, the kingdom of heaven is very, very near. And please pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.